as important for the low feeders. I suppose it wouldn't be because they don't need as much. But in any event, Chip's here to for the whole hour and would be happy to take your questions. 503-231-8187. Coming up half past the hour, we do have a new garden stumper, a little bit different this time, more related to the sun. Yes, as a word rather than plants. There. We'll also, right at the end, if we have time, we'll talk about what's going on in the honeybee colony. So stay tuned for that. I've got one announcement. Jim would normally be handling this part, but Jim is in the Midwest. Boy, did he pick a good time to go to the Midwest. Talked to him on Monday. His flight was scheduled to leave yesterday to Illinois, I think. He was going to be giving a talk. I can't remember exactly. Maybe it was on Pawpaws at some convention there in the Midwest. But I haven't heard from him, so I'm assuming that the plane made it out and in. He'll be back, though, next month. But the one announcement that I do want to pass along has to do with the Home Orchard Society, which is having a mid-January Think Spring Saturday morning seminar series at Clackamas Community College. This year called, Think Spring Orchard Care Seminar. I've been involved with this in last year, I think it was. And they've got, of course, another good lineup of folks. John Saltvight will be talking about, is it possible to have a permaculture orchard, I think is this title, something like that. John's been on this show. Also, let's see, one of the fellows from Jim Oliphant? Is that how you pronounce that name? Don't know. Growing small fruits or something like that. And then Bruce Nelson, instructor at Clackamas Community College, will be talking about something with orchard care. I can't remember. I don't have it in front of me. What I do have in front of me, however, is the date and the time, January 18th. That's a Saturday from 9 to 1. You register through Clackamas Community College. I think it's pretty reasonable. $15 or something like that. Not much at all for 4 hours of instruction. So that's all I have. Anything on your event calendar, Chip?
No, the Master Gardener trainings are starting, so that takes a lot of time right now.
That's right. And you have your own out there in...
We do. Normally, we're part of the Metro Cycle. This year, I'm doing the class in Vernonia.
That's right.
A little bit more rural. So we're a little out of cycle, but I'm still teaching some of the Metro classes.
That's right. Yeah. Some of them, it seems like it's quite a few of them, isn't it?
This year, it's two.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Instead of the usual four.
Well, that explains that then.
It does.
All right. Well, garden stumper, or not garden stumper, our plant of the month this month, I thought, and if Chip may have some answers here, I'll just spring it on him. Though I wanted to kind of hit on, are there some new varieties that are available, or some of your favorites is vegetables or fruits for that matter, that you would like to expound upon?
I'll tell you one variety that isn't new, but I discovered it last year for the first time, is a variety of lettuce called Cherokee. And Cherokee's an old OP, open pollinated line, uh-huh. And kind of a red leafed, sort of a in between a butter and a bib lettuce type. But it's got a nice firm, fairly thick leaf, and really holds up well in salads and sandwiches, and very good flavor. So that was a pleasant surprise last year. Ended up getting a plant from somebody and growing it out, and I'll be buying the seeds this year. The seeds are available. I think Johnny's has them, and Frank Morton Seed down in Corvallis, I think, has them, Philomath.
Okay.
So it's a variety that is around, Cherokee.
And it held up well in heat?
It held up well in heat. In fact, it was being put into a test in New Mexico, and I haven't heard the results yet, as to how there were a whole series of varieties that were being tested for heat resistance, and Cherokee was one of the ones that had gotten suggested for that, I found out later. So,
if a lettuce is not heat resistant, what does it do?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. Part of it is sort of the growth cycle. It is an annual plant, so it's growing, and it ultimately aims to, just like any annual plant, put up floral stalks, and well, the flowers are pretty minute, and then go to seed. As it starts into that process, it becomes potentially increasingly bitter. And so that's kind of a heat relationship and some of the genetics of the plant, what the triggers are, how long it grows. We have, for example, within the romaine group, which are lettuces I really like, there are real differences in how fast they bolt to seed given a certain amount of heat. So if you're looking to have some midsummer lettuces, get some seed for some of those that are good in the midsummer and plant them in, you know, start them in maybe June or mid-June, and then go from there. But maybe have some different lettuces for earlier. So another variety that's heat resistant that I've tried, and it's really pretty good, it's a green leaf lettuce, is called Manoa, and it was actually developed in Hawaii and for use as a commercial fresh market lettuce in Hawaii.
Well, how is that spelled?
M-A-N-O-A.
M-A-N-O-A. Oh, Manoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's actually where the University of Hawaii is located, in Manoa, which is on the outskirts of Honolulu. And that's part of their research breeding program. So it's, again, a public seed.
Huh.
It's quite an old seed, actually. It's about 30 years old.
But it does okay.
It seems to do okay here.
Elsewhere, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, and there are, you know, you can buy, I don't know what they call them, blends of lettuce seed that are, you know, for cold season or summer.
Right.
You know, what do they call it?
Heat resistant,
yeah. I guess. So, yeah. Right.
No, it's actually amazing the amount of varieties of lettuce and all sorts of things that are available to gardeners. That, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, we were picking from handfuls of different varieties that were widely available, and now there's truckloads of varieties that are available. It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Which raises the issue, though, of keeping records of what you grow, and kind of that will, if you grow something that you really like, then you remember next year what it is when it comes time to ordering seeds and that kind of thing. So keep some records of things that were good or things that, for whatever reason, didn't work out.
Yes.
And why.
I try to trial, so to speak, a new variety every year of something, you know, maybe a new tomato, and kind of stick with the standard tomatoes that I like and grow and do well, and so, then slip in a new one.
Okay, so what are your standard tomatoes? What are your favorites?
Well, Early Girl is just always a good producer, just is going to be nice looking, good flavor, produces just...
Agreed.
Sun Gold.
Mm-hmm.
I tried a new variety in two summers ago called, this is cherry tomato now, called Honey Drop.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't paying too much attention. And I knew I planted two plants of it. And one turned out to be yellow gold and the other turned out to be red. Very odd.
That's very odd.
And they were both extremely tasty, different than Sun Gold, a little not maybe as sweet, but maybe a little more tomato-y flavor. But man, I thought that was good. And I only had three seeds, I think, left over from the packet, and I planted those, and maybe two grew out this past summer. And so I planted them both. I thought it's worth the space for that. And gosh, I was disappointed in it.
Okay.
So I'm going to try it again this year, order new seeds, and they were both red last year. So I'm going to try it again, and it was called Honey Drop. So we'll see if...
The Sun Gold is the standard for the really sweet cherry tomato. Mm-hmm. It's an orange tomato. It actually does have decent sugar acid balance. And actually, I think mixes well when you're making a salsa, that you mix it with other tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And it adds a little bit of sweetness and you don't lose the edge. And there is some flavor there, some decent flavor. So it's a jungle vine, though. I mean, they're huge. Sun Gold can be huge plants.
Yes. And we'll keep producing.
Well, all the way through.
It's an indeterminate, as we say. It'll keep going until frost and cold.
But determined to grow.
Yes. Another one of my favorites, that I haven't been able to grow for a while, is Early Cascade.
Mm-hmm.
And what Territorial told me was that the rights to that had been acquired by Monsanto, and they just didn't sell that many seeds, so they were kind of discontinuing that line.
Huh.
And I'm assuming it's an OSU.
I don't think one. Early Cascade was an OSU one.
Oh, well,
I think it might have come out of WSU or may have been independent. It is a good tomato. And if somebody can find the seed, it is a very good early tomato.
Just to add to that, early and late.
Early and late, right. Yeah. It's a very productive tomato. The interesting thing for a lot of varieties around here is that when we grow some of the heirlooms, a lot of them came from places that were warmer than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of tomato varieties that won't set fruit if the night temperatures are dropping below 55 degrees. You know, the flowers simply won't set fruit. And so some of these varieties, like Early Girl and Early Cascade and some of the Oregon bred lines, have the virtue of being able to set fruit in those cooler temperatures.
Uh-huh.
So it gets started early. And that's crucially important. And then as it warms up later on, some of the heirloom types that are more sensitive to cooler temperatures can come on and produce well later on in the season. So
yes, it's just a good lesson that, you know, one tomato plant won't do.
No. There's a Czech variety called Stupice, S-T-U-P-I-C-E.
Yeah. Is that how you pronounce it?
Well, I don't know. I pronounce
Stupice.
It.
it's Czech, not Italian. Okay.
I guess. Anyway, I found that to be a really good early variety, too, for flavor and being able to set in cool temperatures.
Just in general, my observation is that I'm not real enamored with the early variety flavors.
They're not as good as the later ones, right? Because again, you're not getting the sunlight and you're not getting the sugars, the intense heat that you'll get later on to drive those things.
Yeah. But, you know, if you can get tomatoes 2 or 3 weeks early, that's probably worth it.
They're definitely better than anything in the grocery store at that time.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point. Okay, so have you heard of any new varieties on the horizon? You've mentioned some that are...
Yeah, but you know, I haven't really looked through catalogs yet this year, so I have to say, what I encourage the gardeners that I work with to do is to grow something that they like, they've never grown before. So if you haven't grown parsnips but you like them, try to grow them. And then try to grow something that you don't think you do like, and you may find out that it tastes much better coming from your garden. So... Those are in general cropping senses. So like, you know, even okra, which is a very heat-loving plant, but there are some short-season okras now, and if you have the right location, there are lots of opportunities to grow things.
Well, that's good plants of the month here that we're talking about, because it is time to start ordering seeds or looking through the catalogs and get it on. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's too early to order. I know one of my favorite catalog and companies in the past is Fedco, about as far away from Oregon as you can get out of Maine, but I do like their business philosophy, and it's a cooperative and mostly organic growers, they carry some of Frank Morton's lettuce things and some other veggies that have been bred even in Oregon in the Northwest.
So. Absolutely. One thing about seeds that's worth talking about, there's a real temptation that all of us have to save seed. And the old way we used to measure how good that seed was going to be was to do a germination test. So you'd take, you know, if you had a whole bunch of seeds left over, you might take 10 of them, put them on a paper towel, get them wet, just watch how many germinated. If 8 out of 10 germinated, you're probably good to go. The thing we're finding out now is that seed vigor decreases faster than seed germination. And so while it might germinate, it might not be as vigorous a plant coming out of the ground as it would have been if it were fresher seed. So that's just something to bear in mind. So I wouldn't... Every kind of seed has sort of its own length of time you can keep them. Onions are very short-lived, like a year to 2 years on onions is maximum. But some of the beans and, you know, tomatoes, and if you've kept them in very cold conditions and dry conditions, they can store for quite a while. But eventually the vigor declines, tracking kind of ahead of the decline in germination. So
Now that's a new wrinkle.
Yeah. And actually, we don't know how to measure the vigor thing very well yet. We're trying to get measures so that can be part of the information you get on a seed package. But it's not quite.
I guess my thought has always been, well, if it germinates, then, you know, you're good to go.
Yeah.
But
vigor is a real deal, and it is entering the commercial trade as part of the screening for which varieties to plant. So,
well, that's a good argument for sharing seeds.
Yeah.
Buy a packet and spread it around, and then buy a new packet next year and get fresh seed there. Okay, well, Tammy, let's take our first musical break. We've got a theme in the music going this time. We always have a theme going here. This is The Return of the Light is the main thing here. This is Melvin Sparks called The Light Is On here. Melvin Sparks, guitarist. You might think he's an organ player, but nope. That's the light is on. Just remember that here, coming up for the garden stumper here. Okay, Tammy informs me we have a question. I mean, a caller. So, good morning, caller. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi there. This is a little off topic, but it's something that worries me every year. And so I have a lot of trees, a lot of shade, and one of the things is I do a lot of raking leaves, which I do kind of slowly. And every year I worry about the worms. We have a lot of worms, but you see them pulling the leaves down into the soil. Mm-hmm. And should I be leaving some leaves, or am I inhibiting their health by taking the leaf burden off of the lawns? I know it sure helps the lawn. Well, our lawns aren't fancy lawns. I mean, they're more like pasture in reality. But anyway, it's good to have those worms everywhere. And is that a problem for me to be cleaning all of the leaves off?
Go ahead, Chip.
Well, I think...
Odd question.
Yeah, no, I think your instincts about the lawn, though, lawns really are high sunlight requiring plants. Grass is a high sunlight requiring plants. And if you want to remove grass, for example, from your vegetable garden, one of the best ways to do it is to cover it with a bunch of leaves or black plastic or something like that.
We have mulched our garden many times that way, and it really does work.
Right. So your issue, though, with the lawn, I think, is well taken. And I think these earthworms are going to figure it out. In a lawn, it's a stable plant community, more or less stable plant community, and so you are building up organic matter, and they are taking the sloughing parts of roots and all sorts of things that they consume, and using that. So they might like the leaves as a treat, but I don't know how you supply it, in just the right. I suppose if you ground some, if you shredded some up or something like that.
I didn't think of that. Just kind of mowing a few of them in.
Yeah, mowing a few of them on top. Yeah, just that would probably work.
So your question deals specifically with leaves and worms on the lawn.
And actually though it's good because they're so mobile. On the farm, we've studied worms, and sometimes worms will carry organic matter down 2 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And no question. They're so mobile that having a good, healthy lawn source is important to me because it's not really good lawn, but it does, it's under the apple trees and stuff, and so. And so it kind of helps support the garden, I think, also.
Yeah. No, in fact, we've known for years in our commercial orchards where they're trying to, lime doesn't last forever in a farmer garden. And so but once you have a commercial orchard, you really don't dig it up to apply the lime, so you have to put it on the surface. And basically, most of that lime travels down into the soil where the active root systems are through worm channels.
Yeah.
That's kind of a major route for it, and it takes longer. It doesn't, it's not there right away. So, yeah, they're very important.
Well, I just didn't know. I was wondering if the worms feed very much on grass, but, grass has a very different food. It's a different kind of a food source than a leaf, and I just was wondering maybe I should. But that grinding the leaves up, and then they'd, then they would work down under the, and it'd be good for the lawn, actually.
At least according to what I've learned from Elaine Ingham, formerly OSU, that worms are really predators, and that they eat, what they're mostly after is bacteria that are on these surfaces
of
the organic
that.
Fat surfaces. Right. So it may be less important what's there is the organic source.
Yeah.
Leaves, grass. There's no leaves during the summer, and they survive.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but even tree roots are going to have very shallow feeder roots and micro roots and things like that, and so there's there's some portion of the tree available to them under the ground.
Okay.
As Glenn was talking about,
right.
In terms of food,
I think,
base for fungi.
Whichever way you go, I think they'll survive.
Yeah.
And realize that virtually any worm that you find in your farm, garden, lawn is not native to Oregon. So.
Oh.
Or even to North America. So. They're fine. They'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, I know that
survivors.
That we've changed our on the farm. We've changed the way we leave the wheat straw, and a great deal of it disappears over the winter.
Sure,
and it's taken down in, and we understand that microbiology is being carried down with it, So anyhow, thank you for your suggestions.
You
that
bet.
Helps me out.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
Sure.
If you have another, if you have a garden question you'd like to spring on Chip, please feel free to call us, 503-231-8187. Meanwhile, we'll move into the topic of what to do, if there's anything, right now about the cold, damaged plants.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, as we were talking earlier, the range of temperatures that people, basically from Portland down to Eugene, experienced was really variable depending upon elevation, specific locations within this area. We were both mentioning we had friends in the Eugene area that had temperatures of minus 10, but I think my temperatures, or where we live, I think we got to about 13 or 14. That was our lowest above zero. That was about our lowest temperature. And so anyway, the bottom line is that what injury is there, we really can't see yet or judge yet. And this cold was interesting in maybe a not particularly good way, because it was persistent for a fairly long period of time, where we got temperatures, quite low at night, and then up to maybe in the low 20s to mid 20s during the day in some cases, or not even that. And so it was a very persistent cold temperature. So the amount of injury is going to be determined a little bit by how cold it got, what the genetics of the plant itself are. In other words, every plant has kind of a hardiness zone that it is comfortable in, and once you start getting below that, they're more at risk. In this case, the things that go dormant, like your deciduous trees and shrubs that lose their leaves and things like that, they were in full dormancy, so they're actually more protected, with the timing of this cold snap than they might have been in other years, where it happened in, say, late November, or when we've gone through the winter and they're starting mm-hmm. to come out of dormancy, and then it happens at the end of January. And those are times when the damage is more intense. So I don't really know what we're going to see. Anything that was snow-covered was protected. So if it was a low-growing shrub or bulbs or things like that, if they had any snow cover on it, they were more or less protected from the cold temperatures. One thing that's important to know, though, is tree roots are not nearly as hardy as the tops of the same tree, because mm-hmm. roots evolved in the ground. And they evolved buffered by that mass of soil, which holds, an amazing amount of heat. And so if you have a plant in a container, it might have, the top might be hardy to zero, but the roots might only be hardy to 15. Mm-hmm. And if it was cold long enough, you could have a top that's okay and it has no functional roots once everything comes back. So there's going to be a lot we're going to discover. People will be buying some things to replant. There's no question about it. I remember the last really cold event we had. I think the call that I got most, because I think it's a very emotional plant for a lot of people, that they associate it with childhood and grandparents' gardens and things, are daphnes. And there are a lot of daphnes that bite the dust when we get temperatures like this. And so we'll probably get a repurchase of daphne program going on this year.
Well, in the veggie garden, I know any potato vine that had started growing, now that's
gone.
It's gone.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But gosh, the parsnips, they're fine underground.
No. In the ground,
even the little bit of the green is still pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. No, those are tough plants. And kale, I mean, it's the wonder plant for cold weather.
I've also harvested parsley, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I haven't harvested, but the leeks seem to be.
Leeks are tough.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Leeks are tough.
And they're still green out there.
Yeah. No. There's a lot of our winter vegetables that we can leave in the ground, like rutabagas and carrots and parsnips and things like that, and then are good. The above ground parsley, some varieties are pretty good. My chard did not do well. It's not dead, but it's not looking happy.
I did notice that, I don't know what the scientific name is, but the common name is this naked lady, a bulb. It's a bulb, or probably a bulb, and it just sends out one stalk, a pink flower, kind of lily-like, in the fall, just by itself. There's no foliage around. I mean, it's just the stalk. And then the foliage comes on a little bit later.
Right.
And it had started growing in the fall here, and it just got blackened. But I've noticed now that I'm seeing some little inch-long new shoots coming out there. So,
Really, I wouldn't make a decision about taking something out right now. The last really bad cold event we had was that Arctic blast that came in, I don't know, it was in the early 90s, and it was when we had been near 50 or 60 degrees in the last week in January, and we were 5 degrees the first week in February. And a lot of plants got injured in that, and we kept seeing things that would leaf out and then start to die, and leaf out and start to die. And it would, you know, there were plants that were kind of in between living and dead for 3 or 4 years. And usually if there's enough surface injury on a woody plant, you know, bark injury, you start getting compromised from fungi and bacteria invading it. And and then that ends up making a plant that's not going to be the perfect plant. But we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, you know, this was you know, good timing for it as far as for the plant's benefit.
In terms of total dormancy, the plants were quite dormant. Yeah.
Right. I also noticed that my garlic seems to be okay.
Garlic should be okay. I mean, my garlic hadn't come up yet at the time of the cold, and there was some snow. We had a little bit of snow on the ground. We had about 2 or 3 inches of snow. And so I'm pretty confident that it's fine. Garlic, we've had areas where we have grown in Oregon a lot of garlic, what was called seed or bulb garlic, in Madras, and that's grown on beds there, and it's kind of lighter soil. And if it gets really cold out there without any snow cover, you can lose everything. You can lose 100 acres of garlic. And so that's not pretty. And this was the kind of weather that could have happened. Depending on how much snow cover they had.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess the word from here is then it's too early to make any decisions. Just monitor it, and we'll let you know on our program too what we discover there. So, all right, let's just go not to the next music, but let's get the stumper started here. Gosh, I didn't. Well, anyway, this is maybe this is a more rhetorical garden stumper, but let's get the theme. Tammy, you got that there ready? There we go. Okay, this is more like a, like I said, might be more rhetorical, although you can go to websites, probably figure this out. But I wanted to point out the difference. And the question is, what's the difference in the sunrise and sunset times between Eugene and Portland? Just 100 miles as far as the bee flies or as the car travels, pretty straight shot. Is there a difference in the amount of light that they have? In other words, the sunset and the sunrise. So to me, it's just very interesting. And if you think you know the answer to that one, you're good. 503-231-8187. By the way, I ran into, oh, now I can't recall her name, the curator, we might say, of the Hollywood Ecofilm series that we had her on, and the Hollywood theater guy, and they're going to do that again this year, they hope, and she's looking for films now to put on this Ecofilm series, and so we should be having tickets to give away to our Garden Stumper winners after that. But so 231-8187, 503-231-8187. Well, if you have a garden question, call that number, or if you have a garden answer, a stumper answer, call that number, and I'll leave some time to explain it, the answer. Let's now turn to nitrogen and other forms of nutrients for our soil and hence plants. And why or what the timing is, and how we were talking earlier about how organic farmers are discovering certain things about certain things.
Sure. Certain things about certainly all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
That's right.
Well, there's two broad classes of plants that we think about fertilizing. One class would be the perennial plants. This could be raspberries or tree fruits or asparagus or something like that. And a perennial crop plant could be a landscape plant. Stores a certain amount of reserves in the plant system. That's what makes it perennial. It has a survival strategy for the winter, which is either to go dormant like the asparagus does down to the soil line, or to or like an apple tree, just lose the leaves and, you know, stand there and take it. But they have some storage capacity. In the vegetable garden, what we're growing are annuals. And we're growing annuals that are everything from Northern European annuals to the Indian subcontinent annuals, like cucumbers and things like that. So it's a huge range of plant material that we're all asking to do a lot in a very short period of time. And these plants are not plants that prepare for the following year other than to produce a bunch of seed. That's their MO. They grow quickly and produce hopefully the plant that we like to eat the most. And in the case of corn, it is the seed. In the case of the cucumber, it's the fruit and the seed. In the case of lettuce, it's the leaf. But anyway, the point is that we ask them to do a lot very quickly. So we kind of have to tune the garden soils so it is the best possible environment for them to grow. And if you're a farmer or a home gardener, you're really focusing on three things. One is you're probably looking at soil pH a little bit, the acidity or alkalinity of the soil. And we manage that with a ground-up rock called lime. And there's regular calcium carbonate limestone, and there's what we call dolomite limestone that's a mix of calcium carbonate to magnesium carbonate, and about a 5-to-1 ratio of calcium to magnesium carbonate. So anyway, both of those change the soil pH in the same way. Both of them provide important minerals, calcium and magnesium. And the other thing that they do when they raise the soil pH is they allow the soil chemistry to change a little bit and allow minerals like phosphorus and potassium and some other what we call cations to be in a form that the plant roots can take up. So it basically creates the soil environment that these important minerals can be taken up by the plant. So that's a really important reason to lime. And normally for a vegetable garden around here, 10 pounds per 100 square feet once every 3 years pretty much does it. You know, so that's not that expensive. And
no, it's pretty cheap, really.
Pretty cheap, and it's a good thing to do. So we got liming taken care of. In terms of the other minerals, the other minerals like phosphorus and potassium, magnesium, we talked a little bit about with dolomite lime. There's other ways to get it. Those can be added in a variety of different ways. You can buy phosphate-containing materials. And if you look at any kind of description of organic fertilizers, if that's what your preference is, there will be discussions about which kinds of things will provide which elements. And so you kind of just work around that and add that as you see fit. And there are guides to fertilizing organic or conventional gardens and kind of how much you need. The key element that we have the hardest trouble understanding in a lot of our vegetable gardening is nitrogen. And the minute we start opening up a piece of ground, what we do is we change everything about it. If we go from a lawn area to all of a sudden starting to till it and work it and grow things in it, it's not just growing some grass and dying and growing some grass and dying and growing some grass and dying. It's sort of slowly but surely banking stuff. What it's opened up is a lot of oxidation, and nitrogen is a very mobile compound. It's a very mobile element. And so in the soils, once we open it up, if we get rain on it over the winter, like 45 inches from October through May, or whatever, it tends to disappear fairly quickly. There's always going to be some residual amount in the organic matter that's in the soil. But the mineralized nitrogen, the nitrogen that the plant actually is going to take up, is going to disappear typically in our garden world. In our vegetable and cropping environment in the Willamette Valley, our farmers will test for pH and calcium and magnesium, phosphorus and all. They don't even test for nitrogen because they assume they start with zero, pretty much. So this is an important thing for gardeners to think about how they add it, the form they add it, and the timing for it to be added. When you don't have sufficient nitrogen for a crop like corn or potentially squashes and, you know, quite a few others that are what we call heavy feeders, they end up either not producing what you think they should, or in the case of corn, they can be these chartreusey, stunted, 3 foot tall little things that look like they don't belong anywhere. They're plants that didn't get it. They didn't have access to enough nitrogen to grow normally. Okay, so the complication is when you work. Am I talking too long?
No.
Okay.
No. We're fascinated here by this.
Okay. Well, the complication is as you work organic, say you grow a cover crop in the garden, which is a great thing to do, and we grow legume cover crops, which will fix nitrogen out of the air, which is a great thing to do. You work it all in, but it takes a while for that biological process to work to get that nitrogen freed up and released in a form that the plant roots can take it up. And so oftentimes you're not really getting a robust nitrogen uptake from that source until maybe July. If you have raised beds and your soils warm up faster, that does improve the availability of nitrogen that's bound up in the organic matter. It happens faster. So that's another good argument for raised beds, because by having the soil warmer, it's available faster. But what we find is that we have to pay attention to our nitrogen amounts early in the growing season. And then with rapidly, you know, vigorous crops like corn, you really want to, when the corn is somewhere midpoint or later, usually about knee-high is the standard, knee-high to a little higher, you want to fertilize some nitrogen, add some nitrogen again to the soil. And because even in the organic forms like blood meal and things like that, it is fairly soluble at that point. You can water it in and you can give a boost to it. So anyway, I think so much research has shown that nitrogen is, we think in terms of limiting elements in plant growth. And so if the nitrogen is adequate, the next thing they look at as well is the phosphorus adequate. But the nitrogen is the key, because it allows the vigor, the plant to develop, the vigor to develop the leaf area, to capture the sunlight, develop the root systems, to capture the minerals in the soil over a deeper profile. And so the nitrogen is the key element. And when we have a nitrogen-deficient annual plant, that tends to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long-winded answer.
Well, it was a great answer. What are some common sources then, you know, organic sources?
Okay.
Because we're not going to be using a petroleum product.
No, okay. So the organic sources that are widely available, I mentioned blood meal, and that's roughly 10 to 12% nitrogen, and on a by-weight basis. So it's a very rich, dense source of nitrogen. A lot of the some of the organic growers that I know are using some of the chicken feather meal and kind of products like that, and those are anywhere, depending upon the sourcing of it, and 7 to 10% nitrogen or something like that. So on a 100-pound bag of something that was 10% nitrogen, you have 10 pounds of nitrogen in that bag, basically.
And so alfalfa meal might be 5%. Nitrogen.
Right.
I mean, it's less. So
right.
Even if they, if the alfalfa costs, you know, less than half.
Right.
Then it's probably better buy.
Yeah. That potential is. Alfalfa might take a little longer to release alfalfa pellet than maybe the more finely ground chicken fertilizer stuff.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, alfalfa would be a good fertilizer. If it's going to be a product that's going to take a little longer to interact with the soil and interact with your crop, then you can apply more at planting and probably get it feeding back into the system later on. So.
All right. Well, Tammy, let's take our second musical break here, and we'll let Chip come up for air here. This is from another guitarist here, Deborah Coleman here. This is called Light of Day. Light of Day.
My heart with hope, I bring better days.
Deborah Coleman, Light of Day. You know, we were chuckling here because talking about, well, should we talk about this? Should we not talk about this? We should at least mention it, that human urine is a pretty quick-release nitrogen source. And maybe, you know, at 10% level there, you don't want to put it on too much. It'd be burning,
yeah.
I guess, chemically burning.
Well, salt. I mean, there's salt, I think, and to some extent, and yeah, in that. Yeah, so you wouldn't want to be... Yeah, you wouldn't want 10%. Sounds probably reasonable, but I actually have not ever made this recommendation before.
Well, maybe I will do an experiment discreetly.
we definitely have a few of my clients, mainly men, I think. In fact, probably all men that mark the edges of their garden in the morning when it's dark as a in theory deer repellent in those landscapes that so many of our rural landscapes are beset with deer.
Well, why not?
Why not?
You know, it's a sterile substance. You know, you don't have to worry about transmitting disease with urine, unlike manure, which needs to be composted first. No, I'm talking only about animal. Mm-hmm. Herbivore animal, not human there that. So maybe that's a good, well, this is, maybe you could just talk a little bit briefly here about in the springtime, why, you know, the soil has to heat up before the nitrogen becomes available.
Yeah.
And then we'll get to the phone call after this.
Okay. So nitrogen is complexed, you know, for example, in the alfalfa meal or even the chicken meal or the blood meal, it's complexed into organic long chain hydrocarbon type forms. It's not just sitting there as nitrate. But for the plant root to take it up, whether it's taking it up from a conventional fertilizer or from an organic fertilizer, it has to get into this nitrate form.
And so we put it on in a form that the plant can't use.
We put it on in a form that the plant can't use.
Something has to happen.
So something has to go through and break down that complex of nitrogen and other stuff and release it into the soil in a form the plant can take up. And so the fungi and the bacteria in your soil are what are doing it. I mean, they're the heavy lifters of all of that.
And temperature plays
temperature and water saturation play a huge role in that. You want enough moisture, but not too much. This is, again, why raised beds are so good, because the temperatures go up faster, so your biological activity goes up faster, and your moisture, you can manage a little. It's not just water saturated like it would be often in many early marches without raised beds.
So raising the temperature is good on several respects. One, you can get the seed germinated.
Right.
Which you wouldn't need the nitrogen for that. It's self-contained there. And then, two, you need to, those organisms are then active at warmer temperatures.
Right. And actually, even your plant roots are going to grow. Anyone who's raised seedlings on heated trays, you know, or heated mats or things like that, I mean, they know there's a huge difference in plant responses to warmer root temperatures. It's not just about nitrogen and mineral availability. It really is about the preferences of the plants themselves on these annual plants to grow quickly in the most ideal condition. So, I mean, for example, peas, we think of them as a cool season crop, but if you put row covers over them, or if you put clear plastic down before you plant the pea seeds, let the soil warm for a little bit, take the plastic off, put the row cover on, you have another bed side by side where you did none of that, you'll be harvesting your peas 4 weeks earlier with that early starting of more warmth.
And you just wrote about this in your newsletter there.
I might have.
Or I read about it recently, yes. or I went back and read it. But yes. I should pass along that you don't have to be a master gardener to read the Country Living newsletter. You can read it online.
Yes, absolutely.
Even, and Chip really gives some, I think just sound advice for experienced gardeners as well as newbies.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So, Tammy, let's take the call. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi, my question is related, and you've already started answering it there. So I've been an urban gardener in the Northwest all my life since I was a kid, so I have a little feel for it, but I'm too sloppy. I never finish my compost all the way, and just with the stuff that's in my garden, I always have an unfinished topsoil that has all the leaf and stick bits in it, and I'm always trying to plant seeds in it in the spring and they don't germinate. And then if I can get them to a size where the roots get down a few inches to the soil, they do well. So the question is, how can I help my soil finish off those organic pits and be ready for planting?
And another related question might be, well, when should you put on this compost? Chip?
Oh, okay. I mean, a couple of comments. And Glenn, I think you know a lot about this too. One is that if you added the compost in the fall, you would be allowing a slow but steady rate of decomposition going on in the fall. Potentially, even if you covered it with black plastic and it would warm things up a little bit, or clear plastic, it might go a little faster, although you have to make sure there's enough moisture there. The other thing is, as you incorporate it into the soil, you put it in more direct contact with the microorganisms, the fungi and the bacteria and the actinomycetes and all the thousands and thousands of things in a composting environment, you would encourage that decomposition faster in the soil. But, you know, a lignified thing like a little stem of a tree or something like that is going to take longer than a very fleshy piece of lettuce or something like that. They're just by their nature, they're more, a little bit more resistant to decay.
And what I tend to do if I'm using a little bit bigger, we'll say, compost or less, not fully broken down, is that I will only use that compost as a mulch. So I'm not putting it on in the, maybe I'll put it on in the fall, but I'm certainly not putting it on in the spring. I'm planting my seeds directly into the sun-warmed soil. And then once they get bigger, one, two, three, well, not probably one, but 3, 4, 5 inches, say a broccoli, although I normally transplant in broccoli, but then I will mulch around that with this larger compost.
Yeah.
Caller, does that make any sense?
Yep.
When have you...
Like
when
maple leaves are a disaster in my compost, even if I add lime to them to deacidify them.
Yeah. Maple leaves, you know, they're big and they're flat, and they tend to sort of cake together. And that makes them a little bit resistant to composting. Any way you could shred them up will speed that process immensely.
And maybe just change your whole mindset is that, well, you're not putting on compost, you're putting on mulch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it'll break down. You put it on in May, mm-hmm. after your, you know, around your tomato plants, after you set them out, mm-hmm. put your compost around that big leaves, whatever, and leave them on till next year, and they'll be broken down pretty well. Okay.
Okay.
That's another way to think about it.
Okay, thanks.
You bet. Okay, well, that's very good information there on the nitrogen, raised beds, and why we need that heat, and why sometimes organic farmers are, you know, at a little bit of disadvantage there in that, you know, we need that heat before they really get full production. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're using an inorganic fertilizer, those nitrogens are already in the forms that the plants can take.
Pretty much, although some of the same dynamics of heat and root growth are still there, but not quite so critically timed.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have any answer on the garden stumper, so I want to just mention the answer to this here. We do have a call, but I doubt it's for the garden stumper. So I'll tell you here that, wait, we think we do have an answer here. Let's put this person on here. Maybe they have the right answer here. Good morning. You have an answer? Okay. Well, if he doesn't want to be on the air, then I'll have to tell you that the earliest sunset in Portland is 4:27 p.m. in the afternoon, 4:27. And it's that way for about 8 or 9 days, starting about December 5th. It's not around the equinox. It's earlier than that. And on the about 9 days later, which would be the 13th or something like that, then it starts inching out a little bit, 4:28 for 1 or 2 days, and then 4:29. In Eugene, the earliest that the sun sets, I think, is 4:34. So there's about...
It's the equator.
Right. It's just closer to the equator. So what that means is that in the summer, our sunset will be later by 7, right, at the very latest than in Eugene, just 100 miles away. And, of course, it's the same on the sunrise. The earliest sunrise that we, or the latest sunrise that we have is 7:51. And that starts late December and goes to... No, wait a minute. Yeah, late December, and it goes to about January 5th or so, and then it starts turning around. The solstice is when there is the least light.
Right.
Because it's, and in Eugene, the early or the latest sunrise is seven minutes or something like that before ours there too. So this time of year, they really have a longer daylight than we do. And that's that. Any question there? I mean, a caller? Yes. Okay, we have time for one last caller. Good morning. You're with the Dirtbag. Not that one, Eddie. He's gone. Okay, well, just a little bit of time here to wrap up. Anything there on your notes that we haven't covered there?
No. I was going to ask you about the bee, the hive.
Oh yes. Well,
the
what's
hive
going
report.
What's going on the hive?
Yes.
Well, this is oftentimes this time of year we'll see bees bringing in pollen, mm-hmm, because once again, honeybees don't hibernate. But we need that warmer weather, and we just haven't had it. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if today that we'll see some bee flight and maybe bringing in pollen. You know, the question is, well, what is blooming now? Well, there's some Oregon grape varieties that are early. The witch hazel is just about ready to start.
And Oregon hazelnut, the wild filbert.
The catkins on those, yeah, and the alders will be source of pollen. Not much nectar being produced by plants this time of year. But they don't need that as long as there's enough honey in the colony. So we hope that there's some warmer weather. Okay. So the bees can start flying. And towards the mid part of this month, typically the queen will start laying eggs again. She takes about a 2-month hiatus, mid-November to mid-January, and will start up again. Meanwhile, I'm keeping pretty good records on which colonies have already died off and which ones are surviving, maybe started with 100 colonies or so, mm-hmm, going into the fall, into the winter, and maybe I've lost maybe 15. Mm-hmm. Of those, mm-hmm, and many of those that I have lost were queens that came from California or Hawaii, which, uh-huh, is what we see, that, mm-hmm, they just aren't very well, they don't adapt very well here, mm-hmm, for survival. They're good honey producers during the summer, mm-hmm, but they don't survive, and that's why, you know, I started this project along with Tim, mm-hmm, to raise queens in the city to try to get a better record for overwintering. And so far, out of, I think we have 17 queens that we're tracking, just one has died.
That's very good.
Yeah, so far so good on that. You know, we're not out of the woods by any stretch, and we want to see a 60-degree day here in, you know, sometime in January or February to get some flight on that. Yes, I know we're almost there right now out there. So we shall see. I'll keep you posted on that. And hopefully this weather will have a more normal weather, and which would allow trees and plants and other things to produce a more normal type of nectar supply. Last year wasn't a great honey year by any stretch. Better in Portland. In the Willamette Valley, it was really down, from what I understand. Huh. That's it. Chip, as always, thank you very much for your wise counsel.
Well, Glenn, I enjoy being here.
Very good. Chip Buble is the Columbia County Agricultural Extension Agent, OSU. And, gosh, you've got to have retirement somewhere. But I hope not for a long time there, because we all benefit from your knowledge there. So, Tammy, thank you very much, and thank you, listeners. We'll be back on February 12th. We'll be in the middle of membership drive then, so bring your checkbooks. Thanks for listening. Be well.
Thanks for tuning into KBOO Portland today. And the Dirt Bag has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or at hopworksbeer.com. Stay tuned for Jazz with Nick Guffro coming right up after the news headlines. Well, I fall for a year.
This is KBOO Headline News for January 8, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, a group of Vancouver teens claimed that a local promoter hired them, but they never received payment. The teens worked for Blackboard Music in October, promoting a haunted house in Vancouver. The promoter asked the teens to pass out postcard-sized flyers and to put up posters around the city. The head of the company, Chris Martin, has not provided a full explanation for why the teens haven't been paid.
After marathon negotiations Monday and Tuesday between Portland Public Schools and teacher union representatives, Portland School Superintendent Carol Smith described the outcome as a letdown because no resolution was reached. Key issues still to be resolved are whether to preserve restriction on teachers' workloads and whether to cap the district's contribution to teacher health care costs. The Oregonian announced Wednesday that school leaders are offering large concessions on workload and health insurance in order to avert a strike. The school board has given its negotiators the green light to continue talking with the unions.
U.S. exports hit an all-time monthly high in November, with record levels in petroleum and services, claims Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker. This reduced the nation's trade deficit to the lowest point in 4 years. Net exports were stronger than expected, and imports showed a sharp decline, mostly because of a major drop of petroleum products. It could be a record year for exports, which currently support 10 million U.S. jobs. The trade deficit for petroleum products for November was the lowest since late 1996. As the U.S. becomes more energy independent and the export of energy continues to edge higher, the trade balance with oil-producing countries will improve sharply over last year.
J.P. Morgan will pay the ridiculously low fine of approximately $2 billion for its criminal role in Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme that resulted in the defrauding of charities and private investors of $65 billion. Investors thought this crime would put J.P. Morgan in jeopardy of facing major penalties. About $11.9 billion of that total has been recovered to date, and none of the settlement money is tax deductible for the bank. The settlement is also expected to require J.P. Morgan to acknowledge the findings of federal investigators and to beef up the bank's internal monitoring procedures. The company has paid over $20 billion in fines to settle with government investigators in the past 12 months. Meanwhile, Madoff victims continue to pursue J.P. Morgan for their losses.
In international news, in 2000, the Chinese government banned entertainment systems, maintaining that they would adversely affect the medical